With the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Taylor Hillman.
If you haven't heard, we may be seeing the first signs of a potential end to the Chinese tariff threats and ongoing trade spat with the country. Good morning and thanks for joining AgNet West today. There are reports of a deal that could bring relief to U.S. agriculture who are facing new tariffs from China. That's our lead story and it's coming up here in just a minute. Brian German has some information today on meetings and a way that you can nominate a woman for Agriculture Woman of the Year. Danielle will also join us later on with more information from the Animal Ag Alliance and where they're focusing their agriculture message. And also, it's just about cantaloupe season. For you melon lovers out there, California Cantaloupes is gearing up for the season and reporting that the first early season melons are being harvested in the low desert. They have lots of ideas on how to enjoy melons this summer, other than just simply eating them. You can find that information on their multitude of social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest pages. But for now, let's get to today's top story. News of a possible deal that could end tariff threats with China surfaced this week. Reports claim that President Trump is crafting a deal with China that would relieve the country of U.S. sanctions on equipment maker ZTE. The Washington Post reports in exchange that China would return to the status quo for U.S. agriculture, along with backing off other tariff threats. American Farm Bureau Federation trade advisor Dave Salmonson said the deal could be the protection for agriculture that Trump has promised.
This potentially could be a way out for some of these things. Maybe this is certainly part of what we want to have happen, which is a negotiated process, not using the tariff tool, but getting talk, using other measures perhaps to try to get past these issues of just going to tariffs to solve underlying steel and technology problems.
The news is a little surprising. Agriculture is rarely the sole chip in any of these talks, but Salmonson said it's likely due to the fact that the administration is seeing what impacts the tariffs can have.
And they've heard directly from the ag community, so I think they know it very well. Certainly brings up the idea that they are hearing directly about the tariff issues, potential issues we're seeing in trying to get U.S. product into Chinese ports, things that are being held up, that these kind of trade problems are really cropping up due to these tariff issues.
Oddly enough, news of the deal involving ZTE, the fourth largest smartphone maker, stemmed from President Trump's tweets over the weekend that were likely sent from his smartphone. Now here's Brian German.
Ag Against Hunger is accepting nominations from now until July 31st for the annual Agricultural Woman of the Year Award, which honors women within the agricultural industry in Monterey, Santa Cruz, and San Benito counties. Executive Director of Ag Against Hunger, Alicia Kask, offered some more details about the award.
The Agricultural Woman of the Year Award is seeking to honor unique leadership qualities that are held by women working within the agriculture industry within our county. And the winner of this prestigious award demonstrates a significant contribution to agriculture, is a leader for our community, and what we call a true advocate for agriculture. And we typically have a luncheon that we have the surprise announcement for who will be the winner. But this year, since it is our 25th anniversary celebrating Ag Women of the Year, we're going to have a special dinner this year. And that will be held on September 21st.
A public workshop for the California Natural and Working Lands Climate Change Implementation Plan is scheduled for May 18th, beginning at 1 p.m. at the California Energy Commission in Sacramento. The workshop will include a presentation and moderated discussion to gather input on the proposed outline and approach for the development of the implementation plan. There will also be a discussion focused on the process for determining the 2013 intervention-based carbon sequestration goal for natural and working lands. A concept paper for the implementation plan will be released in advance of the workshop, outlining a proposal for information presented at the event. The state has already made significant investments in climate benefits from natural and working lands from activities related to farms, grasslands, forests, wetlands, and other parts of the landscape. There will also be a live webcast of the workshop for those who are unable to attend the event. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
The key to ensuring growth in the agriculture industry is simple. It lies with the younger generation. Officials from Food Tank said the average age of today's farmer and the growth of industrial animal agriculture are two trends facing the ag industry. Hannah Thompson of Animal Agriculture Alliance said while some organizations don't always see eye to eye on topics facing the industry, with these two trends, they do.
It's really important to bring diverse voices to the table who have different perspectives so that we can understand what influential voices are out there and how that impacts our future. And it's interesting because we definitely do have common ground, and that statistic about young farmers and ranchers and keeping farms as farms and getting a new generation engaged in agriculture is definitely something that's common ground. The average age of a farmer is in the 60s. We do need to help young people get involved, get interested, and programs like 4-H and FFA are an excellent way to do that. And they actually got several shout outs throughout the summit. We had Ted McKinney, who is the Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agriculture with USDA. And he started his remarks by talking about how he was wearing his national blue and corn gold for FFA and asking everyone in the audience who had been a 4-H or FFA member to raise their hand. So if we do want to have a thriving future in agriculture, it is really important that we engage the next generation, we help with farmland transition, and we ensure that there are people that are coming into this industry and will be able to continue to help it thrive.
I'm Danielle Leal, AgNet West Radio Network.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now. The monarch butterfly is close to being listed as an endangered species, and the insect creates an interesting opportunity for conservation. Several groups successfully got the monarch butterfly in the process to be listed as an endangered species, something that could happen in 2019.
A petition was filed with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2014 by Center for Biological Diversity, Xerces Society, and others, based on the fact that monarch populations across the United States had been in decline.
California Farm Bureau's Jack Rice said conservation over the last decade has been conflict-oriented, think Delta smelt, but the monarch butterfly may change how we work together in these challenges.
Now, this really presents an interesting challenge for agriculture because we know that the implications of a monarch listing could be significant for ag all across the United States. This is a species that isn't just like a California species or a timber species or anything else. This one really has broad implications. So we started thinking a lot about what do we do? How do we react to the monarch? And what we discovered is that the monarch butterfly seems to present an opportunity that hasn't come up in a long time. And that opportunity is really, how can we do conservation a little differently? It's the idea of working together instead of what we have learned under the ESA, which is conservation, particularly related to the Endangered Species Act, is primarily conflict-oriented. It is about the power of the state against individuals who own and operate the farms and ranches on the land. It is the environmental interest that choose to use litigation as a means of promoting their objectives. They're trying to use the courts to alter public policy. So that we're looking at how does that conflict, how do we get away from that conflict-focused approach to conservation?
Stay with AgNet West for more history on conservation.
Well, in today's livestock news, the 2018 World Meat Congress is coming to Dallas, Texas, May 31st through June 1. This event, which is the premier gathering of red meat industry leaders from across the globe, is hosted by the U.S. Meat Export Federation and the International Meat Secretariat. Joe Sheely has a preview of this big event.
In this U.S. Meat Export Federation report, we preview the World Meat Congress in Dallas, which will include a panel of leading trade policy experts discussing the outlook for the global meat trading system. It's moderated by Darcy Fetter, former chief agricultural negotiator for the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative and now general manager of public affairs and vice chair of agriculture, food, and trade for Edelman.
I'm pleased to be able to moderate a panel of very skilled government officials who have long experience in trade relations. Ken Smith Ramos, who is the chief NAFTA negotiator for Mexico, will talk about how Mexico is positioning itself in the global trade arena. And Jean-Marc Trevia from the European Commission, also very skilled at that intersection of agriculture and trade. The EU has been quite busy inking new trade deals, forming new new trade alliances around the globe and want to hear his perspective about what that means for their meat industry. And certainly last but not least, Undersecretary Ted McKinney, the first official to hold that Undersecretary for Trade title at USDA, who sits at that intersection of policy but also trade promotion, and hear how he is dealing with some big changes in the U.S. trade agenda. So I'm excited to be in front of such a multinational audience. That is really a rare opportunity. And I hope that the audience can leave this panel with a better perspective on how key regions of the world are positioning themselves for the future of global meat trade. Not only how they're looking at their bilateral alliances, but how they see their countries participating in the overall trading system, not only tariffs or trade agreements, but also some of the animal health and the human health issues that have been affecting trade in the meat industry.
For more on the World Meat Congress, please visit 2018WMC.com. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm Joe Sheely.
Thanks, Joe. And the Department of Agriculture last week proposed to amend federal meat inspection regulations to repeal what USDA calls a redundant regulatory requirement for hog slaughter establishments. The Food Safety and Inspection Service says the proposed rule would remove a redundant requirement that requires hog slaughter establishments to clean hog carcasses before cutting. Establishments are required to have a Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Point System, or HACCP, that identifies potential biological, chemical, or physical hazards and the controls that prevent, reduce, or eliminate those hazards at specific points in the process. Because establishments are required to operate under those regulations, USDA says the Command and Control regulatory requirement is no longer necessary to ensure food safety. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
Now, when you talk or hear about farm exports, you usually think of China. That's reasonable. But pay some attention to Japan. You see, last year, Japan imported over $7 billion worth of U.S. beef. There are several ways to break that down, but that figure rose by nearly $1 billion last year. Meanwhile, U.S. food consumer staff members are helping to improve the sale of beef to Japan, and here's an example. See, the favorite cut over there is an 18-ounce steak. This consumer group is trying to sell the public on an 18-ounce steak. That's what is most common in the U.S. Now, if successful, the beef exports could take another significant jump. So far, the effort is working. U.S. cattlemen are pleased with the one-pound promotion because it'll add to beef exports to Japan. That's what they want. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, Agnet West.
This is Farm City News Day by Agnet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Agnet West's Farm City News Day. More agriculture news for you now. Through years of challenges and opportunity, a dairy farmer's resiliency is tested and proven. That's certainly the case for the current market situation. In this segment from Holstein Association USA, a California dairy farmer shares how his family has diversified their operation through high-quality registered Holstein genetics. Lauren Williams reports.
Near the heart of California's San Joaquin Valley sits Ruan Dairy, a farming operation established by the Maddox family more than 60 years ago. In that time, they've experienced many of the dairy market's unpredictable ups and downs.
We've always had these waves of high prices and low prices. You know, I've been like on a three-year cycle. You got to live through them, you fight through them, because the biggest challenge of any dairyman worldwide.
That's Patrick Maddox, who together with his brother Steve manages the family's diversified dairy that's home to more than 5,000 cows on two locations. In addition to selling fluid milk, they market elite dairy cattle genetics by selling bulls to commercial dairy producers and exporting embryos internationally. Registered Holsteins are central to their success.
Our biggest opportunity is genetic gain, you know, through the embryo transfer, through genomics, we can make tremendous gains, make it a more profitable cow. Cow is more efficient, more fertile, a higher producer.
Maddox relies on programs and services offered by Holstein Association USA to achieve genetic goals and progress, including the package program Holstein Complete, which covers registration and classification.
We've always classified, you know, same thing we've probably classified since we had registered cows, so it's always been a key important of our program. We're on a contract classification. We score three times a year. And one thing that affords us to do it even a large operation is complete. Complete works very well for us.
Ruan Dairy was also quick to adopt genomic technology and uses the comprehensive data to expedite genetic progress.
But we're seeing such great results of even the health traits, you know, translating to healthier cows, more fertile cows. And so it's an exciting time in the dairy business as far as what the genomics can do for us, not just the registered breeder putting bulls in AI, but for the commercial dairymen and all dairymen as well.
For Holstein Association USA, I'm Lauren Williams.
While you'll want to celebrate all of the wonderful things about trees today, that's coming up on This Land of Ours. Today is Love a Tree Day, and there are so many reasons why we would want to love and celebrate these wonderful earthly gifts that do so much for us and our planet. Most species of trees tend to be long-lived. There are some trees that live thousands of years. The tallest known tree is 379 feet tall. Aside from just being beautiful landscaping and a shady canopy on a warm, sunny day, trees play a significant role. They reduce erosion and moderate climate, as well as give us oxygen. Large quantities of carbon are stored in their tissues as trees remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Celebrate today by planting a tree, giving a tree as a gift, or investing your time learning more about trees and their significant role in nature. Also, use the hashtag #LoveATreeDay when posting on social media. I'm Kathy Isom for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West, and welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your award-winning chef host with the most. Let's get started. So what we're going to be doing today is how to properly make a potato salad. Now, remember, everybody thinks potato salad is supposed to have eggs in it, but it's really not supposed to. It's a potato salad. This is a very simple yet elegant and delicious way to not only make a great potato salad, but to help you to cool off a little bit during these hot days that we're dealing with right now. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take 2 cups of cooked red potatoes. Now, I use red potatoes because they're waxy. Being that it's a waxy potato, it allows me to do 2 things. The first one is I'm able to cook it longer, and the second one is it has a better bite because the starch content isn't as high as a russet or a regular baker potato. So I'm going to take our 2 cups of potatoes. I'm going to make sure they're all cut uniformly the same exact size. The reason we do them the exact same size so they cook at the exact same time. So I always start potatoes off in cold water and then I turn the heat up. I do not ever put potatoes in boiling water. That's a misunderstanding because what ends up happening is we are not killing any botulism that could be in the potatoes, where you can get botulism from consuming raw potatoes. So remember, start the water on cold and then work it too hot. Don't ever just put potatoes in a very, very hot pot. Once I let my potatoes come out of the water, I'm going to run them under cold water to automatically stop the cooking process. Once the process of cooking has stopped, the next thing we're going to do is I'm going to add to this 2 cups. We're going to start first with 1 cup of mayonnaise. Now, you remember my recipe for making a real mayonnaise. If you don't want to do that recipe, that's okay. You can use a store-bought mayo, but make sure it's one of the more fat-free ones, only because this is a very healthy style recipe. I'm going to add to this 1/4 cup of Dijon mustard, 1/4 cup of capers, 1/4 cup of red onion, salt and pepper always to taste, and I love to add to this 1/4 cup of thick cut chilled bacon. Potatoes and bacon, you just can't go wrong. For this and many more of my Untamed recipes, cooking classes, cooking demonstrations, especially that I will be down at the Oakdale Chocolate Festival on the 19th and the 20th. I'd love to see you all out there. We're going to be demonstrating with chocolate and molecular gastronomy. It's going to be amazing. Go to my website at www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J. Hernandez. You can call me the Untamed Chef for AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. I'm Taylor Hillman. In today's Almond Matters segment, brought to you by Valent, we touch base with our friend John Slaughter at Birchall Nursery. Slaughter tells us about nursery and breeding trends and where things might go in the future.
John Slaughter, plant breeding and product development at Birchall Nursery.
We've talked a little bit before, and we're familiar with your nursery. You gave me a tour before. We're checking in today on some nursery trends. The last time we talked, there was a pretty good interest in self-fertile varieties. Is that still something that's happening?
I think, Taylor, that it's interesting. I think it's ultimately essential for a couple of reasons. But I think that a variety of almond has to click a certain number of switches to be viable. It has to be a quality product. It has to have utility, you know, blanch, roast, slice, brown, confection, whatever. And so it's best if the variety can have anything done with it. And it has to be productive, and it has to be, you know, a sustainable type of practice.
John, you and I have talked before about this. It all depends on what a grower is planning on doing with their orchard when it comes to which variety to invest in.
Meaning there's different growth habits and different varieties, and that should predicate how a variety is planted, what density. You know, if it's a really big tree, you may not want to crowd them. If it's a more vertical or columnar type tree, more efficient, less vigor, you probably ought to put those closer together down a row.
Are there any concerns you have? Is there any issues you guys kind of foresee coming that you think can be, you know, mitigated or changed or made better?
I'd say the biggest thing that I think we need to look at it as an industry is that there's been, of course, as you've probably reported on, a lot of the minimal pruning, non-pruning, et cetera, practices that have been studied and evaluated. And all of that fits with growers trying to hit black ink sooner. And that's good. My concern is that growers are wanting to plant tighter and tighter spacings in general, and that the machinery that we use to harvest and sweep are getting larger. There's kind of a bit of a collision, in my opinion. My concern is that the tree makes you money, potentially. The iron makes it easier. You know, you could harvest with a mallet and a horse and a tarp if you wanted to. Not very feasible today, but machinery is the most flexible thing. Even though you can bust your knuckles and skin your shin on a piece of iron, it is something that you can form and adapt and modify. And so what we're mainly concerned with is trying to optimize the tree and so that it is efficient, productive soon, productive long term, and that the iron needs to fit the optimized tree, and we tend to prune the trees to fit the iron.
The other thing that you're concerned about with the closer, more condensed trees that you and I have talked about before is that the production differences in the different areas of the tree. Talk about that a little bit.
We are trying to breed, select, evaluate, and release almond varieties that have the ability to shake and catch so that dust during harvest is minimized. And additionally, we think that our trees are too stacked as an industry because we have dry gray hulls on the top of the tree, hulls that are green and splitting in the middle of the tree and down in the bottom, down in Portland, so to speak. We have trees, nuts that are bone green and not close. And so we think we need to open canopies more for more uniform harvest. So it is a one-time shake and catch. And that means that we probably ought to adapt some architecture to a broader tree at the base and a little narrower tree at the top and more sunlight sustainably to the floor, or at least the lower portions of the orchard. And so we do quite a few different tree architecture models to try to, you know, even in retrofitting a nonpareil, which tends to be a beast and an upward and spreading tree, you know, it wants to cannibalize or shade its under portions. And while those are still viable in producing nuts, they are disproportionately and, you know, subjected to a different climate, different microclimate, more humidity, less light, less wind movement. And then we have this gradient of nut maturity on the tree. So we think that those are things that need to be looked at as we move forward.
You've mentioned shake and catch now a couple of times in this interview. I know you guys are looking at developing a tree that could be better suited for that kind of foreign practices of harvesting.
We do see the advent of harvest machinery coming in from Europe for almonds. Ideally, Taylor, we would shake, catch, and haul in the field and throw the hulls under the tree because they have significant potassium in them, and we'd like to recycle that as opposed to hauling it away and then buying more potassium in a softer, greener footprint, so to speak. We think that that's, and almond hulls make phenomenal compost. And so we think that ought to be shoved under the tree to make a forest floor. But we think that that's what happens when we move forward.
You've warned about the popularity of self-fertile varieties and that diversity is still needed, simply just for logistical reasons, right?
We think that in developing self-fertile varieties that, again, they need to have utility, they need to be productive, they need to be desirable. They should probably harvest, even if you can shake and catch them and hull them and throw the hulls under the tree, and, you know, that you should have some differences in harvest date, because with for instance, with nonpareil, which still dominates our planting, and independence, which is 100% of an orchard in almost any instance, you don't have a 10-day window to come back and get the wood colonies and then a 20-day window to come back and get the Monterey. You need a heck of a lot of iron to get across monocultures. The way it is now with a nonpareil wood colony Monterey or a nonpareil Monterey, we have a 30-day spread between shake and then shake of Monterey. But if you deal with monocultures, you either need some flexibility in harvest time or you need enough iron to get across these blocks because they are ready.
What else, John? Anything else you're, kind of looking at moving forward? Seems like the industry just, keeps growing and being successful.
I think the other thing that we see is a real interest in irrigation technology, nutrient technology. We've been almond growers because we had some dirt and it's viable. And, I've said for 36 years that almonds have been overplanted every year, and I've only been right three times. So the almond thing certainly has taken a life of its own, and it's an amazing industry, incredible success story. But I think we're drilling down into more technicality with regard to nutrition. I think that, the PM10 dust issue it's not if that is enacted, it's going to be when that is enacted. We think that that's something we need to be on the front foot of, in terms of, let's be ahead of regulations and be responsible.
This is Farm City Newsday by Agnet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Agnet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now. California strawberry growers know all too well how science has benefited the industry. A Pennsylvania grower reiterated that sentiment. Gary Crawford has more.
1967, the Beatles released this song.
Strawberry fields forever.
And back in 67, the average American consumed less than 2 pounds of strawberries. But last year, exactly 50 years later, we were up to a record of over 8 1/3 pounds.
Especially on a hot day like this. People like strawberries.
That certainly helps Brad Warner's bottom line. He grows strawberries on part of the family farm in Pennsylvania, sells them here in Washington at the Agriculture Department's Farmers Market. He says another thing that's been helping his being able to grow strawberries profitably is the research and plant breeding work that's been done on them.
The varieties they have now compared to 20, 30, 40 years ago are hardier. You can get better disease resistance, more uniform size and shape. Better flavor.
Now Brad says fighting diseases and weeds used to be the biggest problems he'd have to handle. Now, though, it's getting the workers to harvest the strawberries on time before they go out of condition to be sold. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
California is getting left behind in rice planting. Stephanie Ho has the national report.
Rice planting is nearing completion in many areas.
83% complete nationally, ahead of average. 80% is the five-year average.
Ahead of last year's 82%.
That was USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
We now see rice planting reaching or exceeding the 90% mark in Arkansas, the number one production state, as well as Louisiana and Texas.
He says the only state that is lagging behind its normal planting pace is California.
Rice emergence pretty much on par, 61% nationally, five-year average 63%, last year a little quicker at 72%.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Now recapping today's top story. News of a possible deal that could end tariff threats with China surfaced this week. Reports claim that President Trump is crafting a deal with China that would relieve the country of U.S. sanctions on equipment maker ZTE. The Washington Post reports in exchange that China would return to the status quo for U.S. agriculture, along with backing off other tariff threats. American Farm Bureau Federation trade advisor Dave Salmonson said the deal could be the protection for agriculture that Trump has promised.
This potentially could be a way out for some of these things. Maybe this is certainly part of what we want to have happen, which is a negotiated process, not using the tariff tool, but getting talk, using other measures perhaps to try to get past these issues of just going to tariffs to solve underlying steel and technology problems.
The news is a little surprising. Agriculture is rarely the sole chip in any of these talks, but Salmonson said it's likely due to the fact that the administration is seeing what impacts the tariffs can have.
And they've heard directly from the ag community, so I think they know it very well. Certainly brings up the idea that they are hearing directly about the tariff issues, potential issues we're seeing in trying to get U.S. product into Chinese ports, things that are being held up, that these kind of trade problems are really cropping up due to these tariff issues.
That were likely sent from his smartphone.
To get more information on topics you've heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German @BrianAgNetWest and Taylor Hillman @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by AgNet West.